I'm about to introduce to you an old and dear friend of mine who is one of the great figures, in my view, of contemporary crime writing. And this, in a way, is a... Well, not in a way. This is a celebration of his lifetime's achievement. This is like a lifetime achievement award. And it comes to people towards the end of their lives. And I think it's a very amusing idea of the Crime Fest people to set us actually in what appears to be a crematorium.
Yes.
And I imagine when the hour is up and you've asked your last question, the curtains will part and Simon will be sucked quietly into the beyond. We will remain here waving, saying we knew him. We were there at the farewell, okay? And what an amusing jacket to go in.
Well, thank you.
I have to say, his wife has been wanting to put that in the incinerator for many years. And now the opportunity has arisen. So this is going to be a celebration of the lifetime achievement of my friend Simon Brett. What's going to happen is we're going to do two things. We're going to spend a little while talking about his work as a crime writer. Then I've got some rather amusing sort of quiz questions to ask him in anticipation of his demise. Then there will be an opportunity for you to ask him fascinating, ruthless questions. And I think the scheme here is that the most interesting question gets a prize, which is rather fun. So it's really quite an exciting event to be at. So I have to explain why I brought this. This is my handbag. I'm carrying my handbag with me everywhere because I'm trying to get in touch with my feminine side, and I've noticed that women do this. So I'm going around with a handbag at all times. Now, it's important to get in touch with your feminine side because, you know, I want to listen better, I want to be more empathetic. I've got a lot of women readers, want to sort of be, anyway. So I am doing this special course on getting in touch with your feminine side. It's working brilliantly. There are side effects, of course. I can no longer really park the car, but... And the coat is there for the quick getaway, which may be more necessary than I realized. Okay, so, you know, but actually we don't mind if you get up and start walking away from us. It's when you get up and start walking towards us that we get just a little bit nervous. So here we are. This, believe it or not, is my phone. But it is also my watch now. So if I check this occasionally, it's obviously to see if anyone's tweeted me. But it's also to see how the time is going so that we don't outstay our welcome. I want to salute Simon Brett. This is him here. And yeah, exactly. The reason he is here today is that he hopes at the end of this, we will leave this room and all go to the bookshop outside and say, Mr. Blackwell, we would like a copy of Blotto, Twinks, and the Ex-King's Daughter, the 80th book by Simon Brett, published by his new publisher, Constable and Robinson. That is the truth of the matter. This man has written 80 books for us. And I want to explore how this all began. And I'm going to ask Simon to give us a little pen picture of his childhood, his time at university, when I first got to know about him, because we are near contemporaries, and his early days, because when I sort of worked with Simon, he was a radio producer at the BBC. At university, he was one of the bright stars, one of the bright new comic generation of his generation. And then he went to work for BBC Light Entertainment, and he worked for a wonderful old fellow called Con Mahoney, who, as I recall, used to wear blazers and polished buttons and be an ex-naval man who ran Light Entertainment and had known all the greats. And so when we began, we actually met people like Ted Ray and Arthur Askey. It's exciting. Oh, yeah. Later you'll want to touch his garb and even shake my hand because I've shaken the hand that shook the hand that wrote Itmar. So that's how I knew him. And then he somehow turned into being this crime writer. What I would like to begin with, Simon, is you giving us a little pen portrait of Simon Brett, the boy, the child, the undergraduate, working at the BBC. What was it about that, your childhood, that led you to become a crime writer? Begin the story at the beginning with who you are, where you come from.
Thank you very much, Charles. I can't remember a time when I didn't want to write, and I think I'll still go on doing it when I stop being paid for it. I'd still be scribbling in a garret. Actually, I was thinking, as a writer, you never quite know when you've retired, do you? I think you just, you know, you realise you haven't been paid anything for 5 years. So I always wanted, first thing I can remember writing was at the age of 7. A lot of writers say there was a charismatic English teacher. I had an English teacher called Mr. Evans at my boys' prep school, and he used to set us great lists of words which we had to learn how to spell. You know, and I got a taste for language. And I remember quite big words for little 7-year-old boys. I remember one week we had impeccable was one of the words. And one of my schoolmates defined it as impervious to other birds. That was rather sweet. And actually the same thing happened when my youngest child, Jack, when he first had homework, he was given a list of words he had to spell, and the first week he had the word what, which he had spelt perfectly, W-H-A-T, but he had to use it in a sentence, and the sentence in which he used it was jolly good show, what? which is but this English master, Mr. Evans, set this class of 7-year-old boys the very inventive or rather morbid task of writing our own epitaphs. And I can remember the epitaph I wrote, which is going to be a slightly difficult death to engineer. But it went, here I lie, S. Brett by name, killed by a lion I thought was tame. And from that time on, kind of everything I did ended up with jokes in it.
You mentioned a prep school. This implies an English middle-class childhood. What year were you born? What did your parents do? Just take us through that. Give us the picture.
I was born in 1945. They'd just got the war out of the way, and then I came. And my parents, my father was a civil engineer, working chiefly in sewerage systems. Mm. And my grandparents were corn merchants, so there is a continuity. And my mother was a school teacher, so, I mean, that was the family background. And sort of, you know, aspiring lower middle class, I would say. And I went to a boys' prep school, but then, in those days, they had direct grant scholarships to various public schools. So I went to Dulwich College on a direct grant thing. So, you know, I can be either side of the education debate if I need to be. We had this system at Dulwich whereby you took one A-level at the end of your first year, sixth, and then you took Oxford and Cambridge entrance if you were going to do that, and then you took three A-levels at the end of your seventh year, sixth. I took my one A-level, then I did Oxford and Cambridge entrance and was lucky enough to be awarded a scholarship to Oxford. And so I checked out with my parents, checked with the local authority to see if I would get a grant if I left school then, and I would. So I left, you know, on my final term I taught in a primary school. This had a repercussion because I was at Oxford in the late 60s, you know, before you it was probably much more relaxed when you got in, but then the gates did literally close at 11 o'clock and you had to climb in, and women were allowed in gentlemen's colleges sort of, I think it was between 4 and 4.30 every alternate Tuesday. Or so. And I had a friend who had a girlfriend, which was in itself rather exciting, and the girlfriend was coming up to stay over a weekend, you see, and the question was, where would this girl, Christine, stay? And I said, oh, well, I've got a sitting room and a bedroom, so she can stay in my sitting room, you see. And in fact, when the occasion happened, because I was a gentleman, she slept in my bedroom and I slept in my sitting room. Completely innocent, so innocent that I wrote to my mother and told her what had happened. And I had this wonderful letter back saying, Simon, don't ever have a woman staying in your room again while you're at Oxford. Remember, you've only got one A-level. Which, I knew what she meant, but... Anyway, I then, as you say, I did a lot of theatre and stuff at Oxford, and then I directed a show on the fringe of the Edinburgh Festival. I went there 2 years. I went in 1966 and 1967. 1966, I was just in the Review with Diana Quick and John Sargent. Interesting mix of people. And the next year, I directed it and co-wrote that year with Nigel Williams. We were the main writers on that. And I'd met some people at the BBC by then, but, you know, Edinburgh Festival finishes sort of early September, and I went home to my parents, and they were very good about it. You know, it was well into October before they said, had you thought about getting a job at all at any level? And it wasn't a joke in those days. You know, there were jobs for graduates, some from grown-ups too. And so I said, well, I've got some feelers out at the BBC, but I'll tell you what, I will go to what was then called the Labour Exchange. And I sat opposite this rather daunting lady who said, have you got any qualifications? And I said, well, I've got a first-class honours degree in English from Oxford University. And she said, not much call for that round here. she said, I'll tell you what, the local department store, Shinners of Sutton, are looking for extra staff over the Christmas period. In fact, she said, I think they're looking for a Father Christmas. And I do still have at home this little green card which says, this introduces Mr. S.A. Elbrecht for the advertised vacancy of Father Christmas. And I went straight from the Labour Exchange up Sutton High Street to Shinners of Sutton, went to the toy department, which, as I recall, was to the right of the lift on the second floor, opposite Ladies Fur Trimmed. And I met the buyer and did a couple of exploratory ho-ho-hos. And at the age of just 22, I was master of my own grotto. I mean, it does look wonderful on a CV, really. But actually, it's not without its hazards, because it was quite hot, because the ladies in Ladies Fur Trimmed ran up this sort of red acrylic number for me and the buckle belt and the boots and all that. And such a Stanislavski, an actor was I, that for the first 3 weeks I actually padded myself as well. No longer necessary. But the real hazard was the music, because they had a 40-minute tape loop of Christmas songs. God. I mean, which is fine for the average purchaser, because you're in and out in 10 minutes. But if you stay in the same grotto for 7 weeks, it does have a very deleterious effect on the human brain, which is actually still with me. I went to a carol concert this Christmas and everyone was belting out Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and everyone came to a perfect unison stop, and one voice, mine, went straight into Rudolph the Red Nose. Is that what you meant by my education?
I think this is giving us a very good flavour. We'll come on to talk about the Santa Claus murders later.
I wrote, if any of you are aspiring novelists, I know you've got some people who have more than aspired and achieved, but I did write, I think, 4 full-length novels before I had one accepted. One of them was called Death in Toys. And would you believe it was about the murder of a Father Christmas in a department store, and nobody noticed because the blood on the red thing, you know. And I did actually, I entered that for a competition in, I think, 1970. Pan Macmillan were doing a competition for a first crime novel, and it was won by Peter Lovesey, in fact, with Wobbled to Death. And I entered Death in Toys and heard nothing.
Now, we need to pinpoint this moment, because this is the key moment for those who are doing Simon Brett studies at UCLA. We'll want to listen to this answer. We have you having been Santa in Sutton.
Yep.
You then do get a job at the BBC. Is it a BBC traineeship, or is it...?
It was a one-year trainee producer job.
And this was with this man, Con Mahoney,
I mentioned. It was indeed with Con Mahoney.
At Aeolian Hall in...
Aeolian Hall in Bond Street, yes. Which spoiled me for shopping for the rest of my life, really.
And you did Light Entertainment programs, and we did, when I came down from Oxford in 1970-71, you produced a radio...
Crime in Rhyme, what was it?
It was Crime in Rhyme. It was called Rhyme in Time.
Rhyme in Time,
with Cyril Fletcher.
Absolutely.
Of the Odd Odes.
And Carol Brahms.
Carol Brahms, a great writer, Carol Brahms, who with S.J. Simon wrote some wonderful books from the 20s and 30s.
The Bullet in the Ballet.
A series of sort of spoof books.
And I remember she was wonderful on this programme, because Giles had devised it, and it was all, we had to make up rhymes, apparently on the spot.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was all heavily prepared. But we had to present it, or the panellists did, as if they were thinking of it like that. And Carol Brahms had 2 pairs of glasses. And do you remember this? She would put on one, and, you know, be something like Giles would set up. What would Cleopatra have said had she met Jane Austen in verse, or something like that? And Carol Brahms would take out one pair of glasses and say, I don't know, I think she might possibly have said something. Take out another pair of glasses and say something like, and then read this spontaneous verse which she had thought of.
So while you were doing this by day, and you then went online editor in television, because we worked together at London Weekend Television, This was your day job, but unbeknownst to us, by night, you were beginning to write And was it detective stories right from the beginning?
The first, these four unpublished books were, one was the detective story, Death in Toys. The others were really getting things off my chest.
Teenage angst, yes, exactly.
But then I had this great breakthrough, and I thought, what about writing something that somebody else might want to read? This was a very profound change in my, and that coincided with, it was through my radio work, actually, because I was delegated to produce a series of adaptations of the Dorothy L. Sayers' Lord Peter Wimsey series. Ian Carmichael had just played the part on television successfully. They wanted to do it on radio. And I worked very closely with the writer Chris Miller, who was adapting those first books. And that actually demystified the mystery, if you like, because I'd always been rather afraid of crime fiction. I thought you had to have a computerized brain to work out the plots.
So it's Dorothy L. Sayers and taking her to pieces,
yes,
as it were,
yes,
that made you understand the mechanics.
Yeah, and I mean, we found very encouraging things like huge holes in the plots, which was great, because, you know, these were meant to be sort of, you know, masterpieces of the genre, but there were holes in the plot. And also, although the plot was important, character and dialogue were at least as important. That was really my discovery. And so I thought, well, I don't know whether I can do plots, and there still are newspaper critics of this opinion. But I think I can do character and dialogue, so that's how I got into writing the first one. And I was also working with a lot of middle-aged actors at the time. I'm fascinated by actors.
You're giving us the clue as to the first of your breakthrough books.
Yes.
So what age are you when this is happening?
I am 28.
So you're 28 by now. You're still working. You're working in radio and television.
Mm-hmm.
You've done Dorothy L. Sayers. You feel you've learnt what she's... Did Ian Carmichael do the radio as well as
the
television?
He did, yes, yes.
And he was a consummate professional.
Absolutely, yes.
So you were doing that. You were enjoying that. And you'd done the first four, which you had sent out to people and they'd been rejected.
Yes, I think in each case I probably sent them to one publisher. But I think, I mean, I was changing so much as a personality that the sort of, you know, the person who finished the book was rather different from the person who started it.
So. And the breakthrough novel was called what when you sent it out?
When I sent it out, it was called Baron Hardup, because it did have a kind of slight Cinderella theme. And I thought it was a good description of this actor who was going to be the central character.
And what was he called at that stage?
He was called Charles Paris. He was always called Charles Paris. And his wife was called Frances, which actually Frances Paris is a pretty silly name, really. But I didn't think of that till afterwards. I sent it to two... It also coincided with my wife, well, our first pregnancy. So I think I wanted to do something creative too. And I heard, like, about a week after our daughter was born, I had a letter from Gollancz saying they would be interested in publishing it.
And it was Gollancz you first sent it to?
Yeah. I sent it, in fact, to two publishers, because I didn't realise that was bad form at the time. I sent it to Gollancz and to Hutchinson. And Gollancz's reaction in about 3 weeks... Very good. Off the slush pile. I mean, I had no agent or anything at that stage. And they said, with a few rewrites, they'd accept it. And then I heard from Hutchinson's about a week before it was published by Gollancz, saying they didn't think it was suitable. Oh. So, I mean, that was fine.
I mean, we will come on later when we're asking Simon to give us his lifetime's experience advice onto this whole question of, because there may be people here who are still aspiring, haven't yet been published, as to how you do it. I fear that today, the idea of simply sending one's manuscript to a publisher that one admires is not going to get you very far. I think now the agent...
I think it still does happen. It still does happen, I'm glad to say.
Would you still recommend it?
I would, because it gives you more power. I mean,
rather than going through an agent?
Well, if you can get an agent, but it's as difficult to get an agent now as it is to get a publisher, I would say. So, no, I think...
And you went to Gollancz simply because you've been brought up on those covers, the look, the brand.
Yes, I looked
meant something.
I looked along my shelves and I thought, you know, which writers do I like and who's published them? And a lot of them were Gollancz. But going back to the title, it was called Baron Hardup. Because of the Cinderella reference. But Livia Gollancz, who was my editor, I don't think was familiar with the Cinderella story, and she thought it was just a dirty joke. So I changed it. And
I ought to explain, I know we have Americans present, what was all this is about. Cinderella, the great story of Cinderella, best told by Perrault in his fairy tales, has become a pantomime in British culture since really Victorian times. And the Victorians introduced the idea of of this father of Cinderella, who marries a second time and gets these daughters, these stepdaughters, who are known as the Ugly Sisters. And in the Victorian versions, he has a variety of names, Baron de Broke being a familiar one. Baron de Broke was the original Baron Hardup, but in more modern times he becomes Baron Hardup. I won't tell you what he's called in the Jim Davidson naughty version.
I think we could probably work it out.
Absolutely. So, but Baron Hardup is a pantomime character.
Yeah. So, anyway, she didn't like the title. So I thought of what actually is, I think, a very good title, but totally wrong for that book. And it's called Cast in Order of Disappearance, which I think is a great title. And one day, perhaps, I'll write a book which it fits. It certainly doesn't fit that book at all. But anyway, that's how it came about. And so that was published when I was 29.
And can I ask you what the deal was, in the sense that we were given a contract, an option? How did all that work? You just sent this off and they came back and said, what?
No, because, I mean, needless to say, I got terribly excited. I think people do get very excited when they have their first book published. I mean, I still get excited when I have my 80th book published. But the contract, I remember I got out my calculator, and obviously I thought, well, I must give up the day job. And I worked out that to equal my BBC salary, I could be a full-time writer so long as I produced a book a month. because I was paid, my advance was £200 for the first Charles Paris.
And how long did it take for that to take off? You found a publisher, it was published. How was it received? What was the original reaction?
They're quite friendly reviews. And also, I had got a contract. I mean, there was an option on a second book. And I had actually finished writing the second book before the first one came out, which I think was very important because you get very, you know, the first book, well, I'm sure you've done so many, but if you can think back to the first, it's very exciting. And, you know, you're slightly manic and you're not quite sure. And I think I would have been terribly self-conscious about writing the second one. So fortunately, I'd written the second one before the first one got published. So, you know, I wasn't thrown by... In fact, when I started, I didn't know much about crime fiction, really. I mean, there were a few that I liked. And I thought I'd written a book, you know, about... an actor detective until Livia Gollancz said, what's going to be the setting for the second one? And I said, oh, the Edinburgh Festival. And I went on to write 17 of them, actually.
Well, of course, this is exactly what happened to Arthur Conan Doyle. I think he only thought he'd written one Sherlock Holmes story.
Yeah, exactly.
Until the American publisher said, you know, what are you going to do next?
Yeah.
So, but for me, the reason I loved your first book is simply because Charles Paris came onto the stage, centre stage, and was an extravagant, outrageous, wonderful character. For you, with that first book and the first two or three, was it driven by Paris? That's what you were writing about, or were you writing a detective story?
I think, no, the detective story was kind of incidental. I mean, I was writing about Paris because I was fascinated by actors, and I was writing about showbiz because I was fascinated about showbiz, and writing that series gave me the opportunity to go into little back alleys of show business.
And really. Was he a real person? Was he your mixture between, I don't know, James Villiers and Robert Steele? I mean, was he somebody real that you'd met?
There were lots of actors who, you know, I mean, he was any straight actor over 40, really. But there's an actor called Bill Wallace who was in who lives in Bristol, I think.
Excellent.
And he was working on Weekending, and he which I was producing at the time, and he was always touring all over the place. But he somehow managed to get back for Friday mornings on milk trains and things to be. And his life was at that stage a little shambolic, and there was a bit of Charles.
And of course,
there.
He looked a bit older than he was.
Yes,
he's actually not that old now.
No, he
seemed to you to be middle-aged.
Absolutely,
Bill Wallace is a wonderful actor. Those of you who like listening to audio books, who may be visually impaired, or just like the pleasure of listening for hours and hours and hours, he actually has done my Oscar Wilde Murder Mysteries.
Has he? Oh, wonderful!
Audio,
wonderful.
Real. I mean, he's
yes.
a wonderful.
He's a great.
And he used
great
to
have
a Wilson, I remember.
He did. He did. And he. I mean, he wasn't. I'm not saying he was Charles Paris, but I did take him out for a very boozy lunch just to pick his brains about. And that's my favoured method of research, actually. the research lunch.
Now,
I'm a great believer in that.
Stick with Charles Paris for a moment. Mm-hmm. You've done 17 of those in all.
Yeah.
As it grew, did you want to do more and more? When did you have your moment that Conan Doyle had, saying, where is Paris's Reichenbach Falls? How can I get rid of this man?
No, I didn't want to get rid of him, and I still, I mean, I hope I'll go back to writing something about him. No, it was just I put up an outline for, and I was offered a rather pathetic advance. you know, considerably lower than previous ones. So I thought, well, I'll try and writing something else. So I mean, it was just
that's why the series.
Yes, I mean, I think I needed something new.
But you did 17
well.
Over sort of 20 years, didn't you?
It was one a year, basically.
And were they? They were done on radio, but not on television.
Yes. I mean, there have been so many options on television over the years that most of the...
This is a warning for those of you who have written novels and haven't yet had them optioned. I'm sure Simon will endorse this. Don't get excited when the option comes through.
No.
Just take the money, smile, possibly tell your partner. Don't tell anybody else.
No.
It will never happen.
No.
Full stop.
This is absolutely true. And also, the other nice experience I've had is that a lot of actors seem to think that they are Charles Parris, and they seem to think that I have some power in making it happen on television. And I've been taken out for lunch by many actors trying to convince me that they are Charles Parris, and the way they try to convince me is to try and drink me under the table. You see? And so I've had some very pleasant encounters.
Who did it on the radio?
Originally, Francis Matthews, who was totally... far too smooth and,
And
very good actor, very good actor. And those, I adapted those myself. That was in the 1980s, I think. Now, of course, Bill Nye is doing them on radio, who I think is, you know, pretty damn perfect casting. But it was interesting because when I started, I mean, I once heard Ruth Rendell say that most crime writers, the investigator they invent is an idealised version of themselves 10 years younger. Well, I went against that with Charles Parris because I then had a secure, pensionable job at the BBC, a good marriage, you know, and I would occasionally have a glass of wine with my dinner. And so I invent this sort of monstrous alter ego, you know, who never knows where the next work is coming from, constantly on the run from the Inland Revenue, broken marriage, lots of unsuitable relationships with young actresses, virtually on an intravenous drip of Bell's whiskey, and the unimaginable age of 47, because I was only, you know, 28 when I wrote it. Well, the passage of time is not without its ironies. because
that's a good opening line for a novel, I think.
Because I know, I mean, I now don't know where the next work's coming from. I'm constantly on the run from the Inland Revenue. Touchwood, the marriage is all right, but I'm afraid I've developed rather a taste for Bell's whiskey. And I'm now actually quite a bit older than Charles Parris, because I aged him very deliberately for the first 10 books. And then I thought, just a minute. You know, there aren't that many jobs for actors in their 60s. So I stopped him. He's perpetually in the amber of his late 50s. Mm-hmm. And I'm now older than him, which is quite a strange experience. Mm-hmm. And I once was doing a talk in Stratford-on-Avon, I remember. And we came to questions. And as is often the case with questions, though I'm sure it won't happen here, people don't ask questions, they make statements. And this guy said that he was a psychology lecturer. And he would always rather refer his students to a work of fiction than a textbook, you know, if it made the point. Mm. And he said, and I always tell my students to read the Charles Parris books when we get onto the subject of the male menopause. And I thought, well, that was kind of all right for the ones I was writing. But, you know, when I was 28, I think. Anyway, there you go. Mm.
So, we have 17 of those, and when are you? Does it enable you to give up your day job?
It wasn't as long as I had feared. I gave up the day job in 1979. I moved. I loved working in radio, and I got a lot of complex loyalties there. And so I did nearly just under 10 years in radio, and then I was offered a job at London Weekend as a television producer. And I thought, well, I must take it because this is clearly meant. But I also thought, well, you know, maybe if my loyalties will be less complex, and if I do want to cut loose, it'll be easier. And I didn't really enjoy my time as a television producer. It seemed incredibly slow after radio, because in radio, you know, you'd be working on half a dozen projects at the same time. Television, it takes forever. And I don't think I was really, because I was so excited by then about the idea of being a full-time writer, that I spent most of my time on a calculator, you know, working out what was the minimum amount of money I needed to live on. And I then got, we'd got two small children, and I just wasn't seeing them because I was making as much from the day job as I was from the writing. They'd kind of got parity. but I didn't have any time. And, you know, I'd rush home and sort of have something to eat and rush upstairs and start writing and that kind of thing. So something had to give. And I remember I eventually made this decision, and I'd done all these sums, and I worked out that at that stage, this is 1979, royalties from the States twice a year, very conservative estimate, 500 quid each time. That was my estimate, you see. And I gave in my notice to my boss on the Friday, and on the Monday, I got my American royalty statement for 6 months, $7. it stayed with me, that figure. Yeah. But so then, you know, I did become a full-time writer, and, I mean, it's been up and down, but mostly good.
Paris is such an English character to me, mm-hmm. and the world is so English and so theatrical. And I can see exactly why people of our generation, I mean, what you saw, I saw too, and I saw those actors and worked with them. So I'm completely at home there. But these novels worked quite quickly internationally, didn't they?
Yes.
And why do you think?
I don't know, really. I mean, certainly initially, I think my agent said, oh, you'd be very lucky to get these going in the States, because at that time, heroes tended to be much more proactive and, you know, strong. And, I mean, Charles Paris is very weak. I mean, there's a joke at the end of the first chapter of the first Charles Paris cast in Order of Disappearance, because at those days you were reading all these James Bond-type heroes who always ended up, at the end of the first chapter, they were bedding the girl, you know, the first girl. So at the end of the first chapter of cast in Order of Disappearance, Charles Paris does get to bed with a girl, but he's impotent. I just thought, you know, that was... I wanted to kind of turn the stereotype on its head. So initially they said, you know, he's too much of a failure, the Americans won't like him. But then they did after a couple of years, and they were, you know, they continue to like him, I'm glad
to
say.
So you then began this new way of life of not going in and not meeting other people.
No.
The new, more isolated writer's way of life. How did you cope with the change of...
I thought it was absolutely wonderful. I just remember, I mean, my first year of being a full-time writer, I was just walking around the house, you know, on a cloud, really. I thought, I don't have to do that. You know, I don't have to go to that meeting. And I remember there were occasions, because I was also writing for radio at that stage, and I wrote a long-running series with Frank Muir called Frank Muir Goes Into, for which I wrote all the scripts, and we did over 100 of those. And I started doing those when I was a producer. And then somebody else produced, and I would just go to the recordings. And after the recording, I could have a drink, and I could go home. I didn't have to go back to the office. It was wonderful. So that first year, and also, I mean, I was at home with the kids growing up, which, you know, I wouldn't give that up for anything. I mean, that was great. And I've now got the empty nest syndrome, obviously, because they've all flown away, and it's just me rattling around this big house.
Well, we'll come to that in a moment.
Yes.
So you have 17 years of The Great Man, mm-hmm. and then you realise you've got to move on.
Yes.
Or did you begin to move on during that period?
During that period, I did, yes. I mean, I wrote a couple of one-off novels. I wrote A Shock to the System, which became a feature film starring Michael Caine. Not a lot of people know that. Not a lot of people went to see it either. But anyway, and I also wrote another called Dead Romantic, which became a television movie. And I think I started writing the Mrs. Pargiter books as well. So they overlapped with Charles Paris. But I was also writing a lot for radio and television as well at the time.
Tell us about Mrs. Pargiter, because another character that we love.
Yes, Mrs. Pargiter, I just thought, I can tell exactly where that came from, because when I was, it's often you can't tell where an idea comes from, but that one I can, because when I was a television producer, I was producing a situation comedy called Maggie and Her, which was Irene Handel and Julia McKenzie. Not the greatest, I think, of sitcoms, but Irene, I just thought, was an amazing character, because she was then over 80, and she, you know, she just got so much energy, and she was doing a show in the West End and rehearsing all day for this sitcom as well. I mean, just astonishing. And I started writing a sitcom for her, which I called Mr. Pargiter's Widow, and I never showed it to anyone, and I only wrote like half of one episode, you know, and it was about this woman living in a retirement home. And I completely forgot about it. And then years later, I'd just edited the Faber Book of Diaries, and I was very intrigued by diaries. And I suddenly thought, ooh, that would be a good plot for a murder mystery if you get diary entries from the murderer, but you don't know which of the characters is writing them. You know, I thought that's quite a good device. And then I thought, where do I set this? And then I was looking through lots of old notes, and I came across this Mr. Pardritter's Widow sitcom. So I thought, oh, if I put that character in. And so Mrs. Pardritter came directly out of that. So there's, very far back, there's a little bit of Irene Handel in her.
And when you're sitting down to write, as it were, Mrs. Pardritter, as opposed to Charles Paris, how conscious are you of that you're actually in another world? How do you make sure that the voice is a different voice? This is a ridiculous question. It's like somebody asking, as they did, the great actor Sir Donald Wolfit, who would go on tour and he would literally, in a week, give 8 performances, and there would be, you know, one Hamlet, one King Lear, one Richard III, one Macbeth, and somebody said to him, don't you ever, you know, get confused as to which part you are playing? And he said, no, when I go out to play football, I wear shorts and football boots. When I go out to play, you know, cricket, I play wear whites. You know what you're doing. But is it a problem when you sit down to write a different character?
No. I mean, people sometimes say, oh, why don't you do a book where Mrs. Pardritter meets Charles Paris? That would be totally impossible because there are different levels of reality. You know, Mrs. Pardritter isn't in the real world. I think Charles Paris is to some extent. But Mrs. Pardritter, it's that lovable world of, you know, Ealing comedy villains, really, where, you know, tasked with golden hearts and villains who are all right, really. So, which sadly is not the real world, I think.
When you approached Mrs. Pardritter, by then you'd learnt about the strength of the series. You discovered through the success of Paris that what the audience requires is more of the same. Mm-hmm. So did you go on, did you know when you started, I've got to do a number of these? When did you come up with the third? How did the process then begin to take over?
I don't know. I remember there was, I think the second or third one, there was a television project I was going to be doing. And then that fell through. And so I rang my then editor and said, oh, have you got room for another Mrs. Pardritter? And she said, well, the catalogue goes to press at the end of the week, so if you can give me a title and an outline for the catalogue, then yes. And so I did a title and an outline for the catalogue and got it in and then wrote the book, which is, I think, often the best way. You know,
just think of a good title, bung it down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And did the actual book bear any relationship to the outline?
It actually did, yes, because it was called Mrs. Pardritter's Pound of Flesh, and so it was obviously set at a health farm.
I thought it was could have been to do with Sherlock, couldn't it?
Well, yes, but and in fact, because it's Mrs. Pardritter who enjoys her food and everything, at the end of the book, at the health farm, she's actually put on a pound, which I just thought was a nice little quirk. They were quite difficult to write, the Mrs. Pardritters, actually, because they were quite, you know, you couldn't fall back on reality. It was this slightly invented world that you had to. So that's maybe why I only wrote 6 of them. I think it was because other things came along too. And in fact, that, talking of television options, that again got very close to being a television series, even to the point of 2 scripts being commissioned. And I wrote the 2 scripts and sent them in, and the script editor thought they were wonderful. And she said, you know, I'd go straight into the studio tomorrow with them. And then, of course, in a reshuffle, she lost her job, and the new broom got rid of all her projects. And in fact, I turned the television scripts into 2 of the later books. So they started as television scripts and then became books.
Just to give people who don't know the scope of your work a picture, we have 80 books in all. Divide them into the main series.
Okay, well, in the crime series, the Charles Paris, Mrs. Pardritter, Feathering, Feathering being a little village near where I live. I always used to be afraid of fouling my own footpath, and I would always write about places when I'd left them. So, I mean, when I left the BBC, I wrote The Dead Side of the Mic, which was set in the BBC. When I left London Weekend, I wrote Situation Tragedy, which was set in a fairly recognisable London Weekend. And eventually, with the Feathering series, I decided I live in this rather beautiful part of West Sussex, and I thought, you know, either I'm going to never write about it, or I'm going to foul my own footpath. And so I started writing this series, and I'm not planning to leave that area except feet first, you know, in the crematorium. But So I started, and there's a little half joke in the name of Feathering, because I don't know if those of you who know the geography of the South Coast will know that there's Worthing, Goring, Ferring, Angmering. There are all these little ings, and there's one called Tarring. So Tarring and Feathering is just a little half joke there.
You heard it here first. Isn't it exciting? You come to Bristol, you live and learn. Mm. Then of course you die and forget it.
And so I've now done. I think I've done 10 of those now, Feathering, and the most recent is called The Poisoning in the Pub, and I'm just doing the rewrites on The Shooting in the Shop. There is a kind of alliterative tendency with people keep suggesting titles to me, actually, most of which are obscene. And now I hope the one that's published, Blotto, Twinks and the Ex-King's Daughter, I hope will also be the first of a series. That is deeply silly.
Now, this is the new one.
Yeah.
Now,
yep.
Tell her, this is Constable and Robinson. This is the one that's just out. This is the one that Simon will be signing copies of immediately after this exciting event, when you may touch his garb and get a copy of his book. What is new? Why is it new? What has brought this about? And why is it deeply silly? Do we want that? Do we need that?
I think so, yes. I mean, as we were talking about on the panel yesterday, you know, crime and high spirits used to go together. They don't quite as much now. So I think, no, I mean, I just hope it's funny. I mean, I think it's funny, but, and it's not terribly serious. The reason I started it was that I had what I thought was a really good outline for a serious standalone novel. And it got turned down by every publisher I approached with it. And so I thought, oh, well, you know, let's give up trying to be real and let's do something that is just... So Blotto Twinks are their brother and sister. They are, of course, scions of a noble family. And it's an adventure set between the wars, though nobody's quite sure which wars. And it concerns it's the ex-king of Middle Europa, whose daughter is kidnapped while she's staying at Taster Towers, which is obviously spelled Torsister. Because it happens on their home ground, you see, Blotto has to go and save her from the castle of Zling in Middle Europa, which is just having a sort of ongoing war with Transcarpathia. It's quite silly.
But is there a crime element?
Oh, yes. Totally. Gosh. Oh, yes. Dead bodies.
This is obviously not exactly in the tradition of some of the early ones you've done, because it's more outrageous and ridiculous by the sound of it.
Yes.
Do you feel compelled to leave your comfort zone at times? I mean, have you done this to make it more extravagant? I mean, have you sometimes thought, actually, I'd like to do something that is much more hard-boiled? I'd like to leave the cosiness of Feathering Mrs. Partridge at Charles Palace and do something more hard-boiled? Or you've retreated with this one into the world of high spirits?
Yes, I think I do. I've got quite a low threshold of boredom, I think. I mean, I don't want to... I'm still doing the Featherings. It's not like I've stopped that. So, yes, I think I do. I do like constantly doing different things and different formats. I mean, I'm still... You know, I still keep writing stage plays and things because I just like doing them, and pantomimes. And, yes, I like a varied palette.
Before we bring in the audience to ask you questions and play my little game, which we're going to conclude with...
Yes.
One of the things that I note is that your books just give delight and hurt not unless you're one of the victims. I mean, they are they're the best kind of champagne. They're just wonderful. They're a tonic, they're a treat. They are indeed always full of high spirits. And clearly you're getting even more excited with Blotto, Twinks and the Ex-King's Daughter. Yeah. All of this becomes more interesting to me when about 2 years ago I pick up a copy of The Author magazine, which members of the Society of Authors get sent, and read a very moving and revealing piece by Simon about the depression that he has suffered from over many years. Tell us a little bit about that and why you wrote the piece and how it, as it were, chimes in with this lovely souffle world that you give us in our books.
Well, I think the depression is genetic, you know. I come from a family...
Oh, you're blaming your parents. Oh, marvellous.
Well, I come from a family of depressives. I mean, I think it's like having red hair. It's just something you grow up with. And I feel very sorry, particularly for my mother, because she grew up at a time where depression was not talked about. She had to pretend everything was all right all the time, which caused her a great deal of misery and a great deal of misery to other people who came in contact with her. So, I mean, it's just... I would say it's much better... If there are any depressives out there, I have found with age it does get a lot better. I mean, I've been on medication, you know, antidepressants for about, I don't know, 8 or 10 years, and they do seem to help.
Did it first strike you? And just give just tell the story a little bit.
I suppose in my teens I was first aware of it. Depression is very boring and actually quite funny to people, outside. I can find it quite funny because, I mean, at my worst, and I put this in the article, you know, everything is your fault, you know. If I was really depressed, I'd be driving and, I'd see the road in front of me and I think, I couldn't make a road. I couldn't, you know, and it's just so stupid. I mean, you blame yourself for everything that happens. But I think, I mean, the reason I wrote the article was that I think it's something that afflicts writers a lot, because, A, you know, the boring thing of writing being a lonely thing, you can only really do it on your own. And you do have to generate a lot of energy to write a book. And almost every writer I know goes into a decline when they've finished a book. You know, I mean, it may be physical illness that they've been staving off. They suddenly get the screaming cold, or they get depressed, or they get drunk, or they leave their wives, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I think you are, it's an emotional roller coaster, and you are digging into your own psyche, which is, also writing is the great therapy too. I mean, you can write so much out of yourself. But I think, and certainly from the mail that I got after that article, you know, it was striking a chord with a great many people.
You've taken us already on a fascinating roller coaster during the last 45 minutes. Let's have an interim round of applause for Simon.
Oh. Thank you.
And let's see if we have any questions that people would like to ask before I play my little game with him. This is your moment to cross-question Simon on his... Oh, yes, a gentleman at the back. Please identify yourself. Tell us who you are.
Norman Price!
Good grief, they're all here.
Dulwich College has produced some other famous crime writers.
Yes.
Do you think it has anything to do with the school, or is it just the
It's very difficult to know the answer to that. I mean, certainly, you know, Raymond Chandler, obviously, P.G. Woodhouse, C.S. Forrester, Graham Swift, Michael Ondaatje, these are all... products of Dulwich College. Whether you can actually say, I just don't know, because obviously the staff changes. I mean, there was a particularly good English teacher called Mr. Jagger, who taught. He taught Michael Ondaatje and Graham Swift. Certainly didn't teach me, because I actually read history. I mean, I got to Oxford doing history rather than English, though I then changed to English. I just don't know. I mean, I was at Dulwich College last week, actually, for the renaming of the junior library as the Raymond Chandler Library. And the senior library is the P.G. Woodhouse Library. I don't know, is the answer. But it is quite striking. Yeah.
They asked me back to my school, you know, to open the Giles Brandreth fridge. Yes, gentlemen in the front rows come all the way from the United States of America, one of our... Most
I have a question. With 80 books under your belt right now, do you find that when you go to an agent or to a publisher that they welcome you, or is each new book a mountain that you have to climb regardless of what you've done successfully in the past?
I've got the same agent who I've had for over 30 years. So it's not that relationship, I think. It's fairly, you never know when a publisher is going to lose interest in what you're doing. I did write a non-crime novel, a book called The Penultimate Chance Saloon, about postmenopausal sex, really. And I had quite difficulty in getting that published. I just wrote it because I thought it was a funny idea.
So you write sometimes before you've got...
Oh, yes, if it's something... I mean, there's a general rule that publishers don't like you doing something different. You know, that is almost definitely the rule. So if you're going to embark on... And certainly, I wouldn't have... You know, I just wrote this book because I thought it was an interesting thing to do. Yes, and then tried to sell it. But I don't think I'd have sold it on Synopsis. And in fact, given how many copies it sold, I'm surprised it got published. Anyway.
Yes, I mean, that people just want the same thing again and again and again. Yeah. This devil, for example, A.A. Milne, who was a very successful playwright before he wrote those children's books, and all they wanted was more plays. And he said, I want to do something different now. And then he wrote detective stories, the Red House Mysteries, which you all know. They said, we want more of those. And he said, no, I want to do something else. He wrote the children's book. They said, we want more of those. He said, no, I want to do something else. They don't like that, the publishers. No. They want you to create a stream, a production line, and keep giving the public basically the same characters, the same story, the same sensation. It's the same reason that we keep eating Bendix vitamins. You don't want to buy a box of Bendix vitamins and find they taste different, do you? We want the same diet, with the same buzz.
Yes.
So that is the problem.
Coca-Cola.
I basically want more Paris. That's really... I mean, I'm going to give Blotto, Twinks and the Ex-King's Daughter a go because you're a friend. but basically, I want more Paris. Beautiful woman in the front row here.
I don't think so. I mean, I know so little about the police that, there is a recurrent line in most of my fiction, certainly in the Charles Parris's, which goes, the police arrived and were very efficient. And it's then followed by Charles wondered, or Carol wondered, or Jude wondered, Mrs. Pargeter wondered. You know, I just don't know enough about it, and it doesn't interest me enough to get all that right. And I think there are plenty of people out there doing it very well. I think, you know, one should home in on what one does know. And I have this, well, it's not a theory, it's a fact, that, policemen in fiction are more interesting the less like real policemen they are. So, you know, if they sort of write poetry or like opera or, no is the answer, Janet.
Yes, lady in this front row here.
I just was very interested in what you had to say about depression and how you felt you blamed yourself for everything, and I really felt I needed to point out that our poor performance in the quiz on Thursday was in no way your fault.
Oh, thank you. No, obviously, I was a little bit of sleepless night after that, as you can imagine.
That's not what I'd heard. No, people were very upset, actually. There was an element of anger. Anybody else got a, before I do my little quiz with Simon? Yes, lady here in the second row. Tell us who you are first.
I'm Jay Finnis.
Oh, yes.
I'm very wary of writing historical stuff because, having gone to Oxford to read history, I know enough about history to know how little I know. I guess the period that quite appeals to me is sort of the London of Dr. Johnson, you know, where it was a very small kind of literate community and everyone had seen all the latest plays, read all the latest books, were in coffee shops talking. I mean, that's a period which quite fascinates me. But I'd be very scared because I'm always reminded, I think my mind is full of admonitory examples of what not to do. And the one about history is that story of the Hollywood screenwriter writing one of these great medieval epics, almost definitely starring Charlton Heston. And he had to write a speech to send the men off to war. And he wrote this speech which began, "Men of the Middle Ages." Tomorrow begins the Hundred Years' War. I'm frightened of it.
It's wonderful. Well, if Blotto, Twinks and the Ex-King's Daughter is as funny as that, we should all be doing well. One more question, or can I... Oh, yes, last question. Yes, lady in the front row here.
Have you ever considered your Oxford days as suitable material for...
Not really. I mean, I guess characters. I've put characters in with that kind of background. I mean, in the book I've just finished, I've used sort of written about Cambridge Footlights Mafia, if you like, which is not Oxford, obviously. Actually, it was. I almost developed a nostalgia for Cambridge, although I was never there, because when I worked in light entertainment, we would always have a party of us young producers who would go to see the Footlights Review, and they'd all been at Cambridge. And for the first couple of years, when they said, "Oh, wasn't it funny when old Greg fed in the," I said, "No, I was at Oxford." And after about 3 years, I just nodded along and said, "Oh, yes, that was funny." So I have kind of a nostalgia for Cambridge as well as Oxford. But I've never used that as a background. I mean, again, now that would be historical. you know, I mean, I was there, well, 40 years ago, I suppose. Mm. So, no, for the same reason that I wouldn't write something historical, I think it's unlikely that I will.
Speaking of 40 years ago, we're now coming to the end. What's going to happen in a moment is we are going to leave here, and we're going to go out, and Simon is going to sign any of his books. I'm also actually going to sign any of mine, but mine are slightly different. They are Victorian murder mysteries, and this is your opportunity to get Simon on this great day. But I want to end, if I may, by playing my little Stairway to Heaven game, since we're going to put you in the behind the curtains in a moment.
Yep.
Pretend this is, for a moment, Simon, the end of your life, and you are now on the stairway to heaven. And I really want one-word answers to this.
Okay.
As you climb the stairway to heaven, you glance over your shoulders before you go through these curtains, and you look back at the world. What is the place you'll most miss?
London, I think, although I don't live there. But, yes. Mm-hmm.
What's the food you'll most miss?
Scallops, because I haven't eaten scallops for a long time since I wrote The Poisoning in the Pub. It put me off them for about 6 months, but I'm now back on them, and I do like scallops.
What is the drink you'll most miss?
Red wine, and Cabernet Sauvignon.
Very good. And the fragrance?
The fragrance. That's, I do love the smell of baby powder.
Well, the perversions thing comes in the next section.
No, I think it's associated with my children and now my grandchildren.
Yes.
Yes.
And are they the people you will most miss? Who will be the people you most miss?
Well, it would have to be family first. And then a sort of mix of friends. Mostly female, it has to be said. Lunching friends.
Mm-hmm. You get into heaven, you arrive, and there's someone to greet you at the pearly gates, a kind of guardian angel. Somebody who is in heaven, one of the great figures of history, or somebody who has died before you. It could be anybody. Who would you like to meet and have take you on a tour of heaven?
I'm afraid it would have to be Jane Austen. I'd just be so intrigued to... I don't think we'd do much looking around heaven, but I'd love to talk to her.
Well, to be with Jane Austen would be to be in heaven.
Absolutely. Yes.
You and Jane Austen, you go on a tour of heaven, you stop off at the Heavenly Odeon.
Mm-hmm.
What's the film you'd like to see?
I would quite like to see Le Cop, I think, which starred Philippe Noiret, and it was a very good, very good movie. Or Babette's Feast, possibly.
Yes. There is a library in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You can go into the library, and there are two sections.
Yep.
First of all, you visit the crime section.
Okay.
What book would you like most to read?
Well, it has to be a Raymond Chandler. Anyone. I'm not picky. You know, any Raymond Chandler.
And there is another part of the library which has other literature, which is not really of any interest to us. but is there any other kind of book you would also want to read?
Is this fiction or non-fiction?
This can be either. This is the rest of the library.
Well, I think I would take Brewer's Dictionary of Phrase and Fable down from the shelf because I just love that book. It's one of those books when you're looking for something, you always find other things on the way and often forget what it was you were looking for in the first place because there are so many little entries which explain common phrases and things. So I think it would have to be my Brewer.
There's a cabaret room, and you and Jane Austen, picture the scene, ladies and gentlemen, are sitting down. You've been given a plate of scallops, some
right.
Cabernet Sauvignon to drink.
Yep.
You're feeling quite leisurely. You know that afterwards there is there Raymond Chandler to read, and you can even sound amusing because you can tell us some things you've learned from Brewer's Phrase and Fable.
Exactly.
But who are you going to have to entertain you for the cabaret? From the history of the world entertainment, anyone can perform for you. You're in heaven. Who will you have?
Oof. That's an interesting one. I think if that Mozart would, you know, tinkle a bit on the ivories.
Mozart plays for Simon Brett and Jane Austen in heaven tonight. After Mozart's concert, you go for a walk. And Jane leaves you as you walk along the parapet and you encounter the Almighty. Now, I want two answers here. One, I want to know what you would ask her. And also, I'd like to know, as you answer this, if there is a spiritual dimension to your life, if, as it were, a belief in something beyond our world actually means anything to you.
Well, I'll do the second part first. There's a spiritual dimension, but not a religious dimension to my life. I find religion rather difficult to believe in. I'd quite like to have a faith, but it doesn't work for me. What was the first bit? What did I say to God?
What do you ask? What do you ask? And what do you say? Yes. This is your moment with the Almighty.
Well, and I can ask him to arrange anything.
You can ask him. I mean, if you're somebody who's actually so needy, you actually go to God and say, I want something, yes.
Well, I think
you could
I would.
Say, I mean, some people, when I ask them this question, they simply say, God, thank you.
Oh.
But it's up to you what you choose to say
well,
to God.
I
this is your moment with the Almighty.
Well, I would ask...
This game is more revealing than people realise.
I would ask God to move New Year's Eve to the beginning of June. Because I think that bit between Christmas and New Year's Eve of paler and paler carbon copies. Christmas Day, I think, is wonderful. I love it. Boxing Day is great. And then you just get these... I once called it a week of Sundays. But, I mean, these paler and paler carbon copies, I'd just like to get on with life and then have a nice New Year's Eve party in June.
Very good.
And God could do that, couldn't he?
He could do, or she could do that for you.
Yes.
No question at all. Well, look, we've reached the end of our hour, and the last thing you have to tell us is what would be, and they're going to be the last words that you say to this audience as well, what would be your last words? You have the last word. God, she is sweet, she lets you have the last word. You've reached heaven, you've achieved 80 books, and we hope, of course, that there were many more to come. But what would your last words, what would you like your last words to be?
I really tried.
We feel you really succeeded. Can we please salute Simon Brett? Ooh! Now this is very, very exciting. There's a prize for the person who asked the best question. Okay, and the prize is Michael Caine. A shock to the city. This is yours.
Yes.
Hey! I'm the judge, so I can just give them out as I want. I know it should be just one prize. Am I allowed to break it up into several prizes?
Yeah.
I can do exactly what I like. Do you have a video CD player, sir? This is a great movie. A great movie. It didn't work, didn't win any prizes, you know. Michael Caine didn't work for 2 years after it, but never mind. It's a great movie. This is a remark. This says here, intelligent, amusing, entertaining Alexander McCall Smith. Oh, it's by me. this is a Victorian murder mystery. Have you got a copy of this already? There we are, that's yours. Oh, no, no. Oh, there. I'm wired in, darling. You needn't worry. And the joy is the further away, it gives you an electric shock and pulls you back. Blood at the Bookies. Have you got Blood at the Bookies? Blood at the Bookies is for you, and you, I'm sorry if you asked a question towards the back of the room. The wire has a little bit, and you asked a question. And this is Blood O' Twinks and the X-King's very amusing cover, and a very amusing looking book, dedicated to Pete, who always had a taste for the city. Is this Pete Atkin?
No, it's Peter Spence who wrote To the Manor Born.
I was going to say that. Very good. Excellent. That's yours. You asked the question. Oh, you asked the question. Very good. Okay, that's been enormous fun. We do salute him. I do recommend any of his books. They become collector's items. Most people's books, when signed, the value goes down. But I assure you, get one of his signed this afternoon and you can run riot on eBay this evening. Thank you very much indeed.
Charles, thank you very much.